Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. Now, you're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and increasingly aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what we find to squabble over. Now, you can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call us from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area to find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show. You just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. And for information and links from these shows, you can go to offthegridstofreedom.blogspot.com or just email me. Lots is happening, and lots needs to happen to make freedom for all of us real. My own blog is titled How the Neocon Stole Freedom and is conveniently located at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com. This week, the story up at the top is on the clash of paradigms now working its way through the presidential debates. Last Tuesday, that conflict came into high relief. And now CNN is offering to continue this honest-to-God real debate, something very rare in the world today, between Ron Paul and Mike Huckabee on their station. And we are all waiting on with bated breath to see what that is going to be like. And as they say, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. That's what Mohandas K. Gandhi said, and that's really one of the things that happened last Tuesday. They started trying to laugh at him, and then all of a sudden they found out that they couldn't laugh. Ron is a dominant presence on the Wikipedia today. You can go take a look at the grow-out going on there. His closest rival is Fred Thompson. Old Fred, better hope that the information that will be coming out there on his sex life and how he's been making his money these last several years does not make it onto the wiki. And here's a few other little items of interest. Judge strikes down part of the Patriot Act, New York. A federal judge struck down a key part of the U.S. Patriot Act on Thursday in a ruling that defended the need for judicial oversight of laws and bashed Congress for passing a law that makes possible far-reaching invasions of liberty. U.S. District Judge Victor Marrero immediately stayed the effect of his ruling, allowing the government time to appeal. Justice Department spokesman Dean Boyd said, "We are reviewing the decision and considering our options at this time." The ruling handed the American Civil Liberties Union a major victory in its challenge of the post-September 11 law that gave broader investigative powers to law enforcement. The ACLU has challenged the law on behalf of an Internet service provider, complaining that the law allowed the FBI to demand records without the kind of court supervision required for other government searches. Under the law, investigators can issue so-called national security letters to entities like Internet service providers and phone companies and demand customers' phone and Internet records. In his ruling, Marrero said much more was at stake than questions about the national security letters. Now, that's a small step in the right direction that we're going to follow with interest. And now, an FCC story on Martin, the coming article on the selling off of parts of the wealth of America. I wrote a short and sprightly article about old Martin that appears on my blog, and you can look that up at How the Neocons Stole Freedom. Now, here is what this story said in our most recent development, and it's by John Dunbar, Associated Press writer, September 4th. It's odd for an agency that has the word communications in its middle name, but the Federal Communications Commission routinely leaves the public in the dark about how it makes critical policy decisions. That secrecy was on display during the recent debate over how the government should auction off the rights to billions of dollars worth of publicly owned airways. For 3 weeks, potential bidders such as AT&T Incorporated and Google Incorporated and a coalition of public interest groups waged a war through the media over proposed rules prepared under FCC Chairman Kevin Martin that would guide the auction. The debate advanced largely on rumor and speculation because Martin's draft, as required by agency rules, was never made public. In fact, even when commissioners approved the auction rules at an open meeting in July 31st, they still haven't been made public. That didn't happen until 10 days later, after the FCC staff had a chance to proofread and fine-tune the language. The auction rules experience is not unique. It is how the agency has conducted the public's business for at least a decade, some observers say. The FCC is auctioning a large swath of spectrum being made available thanks to a transition by TV station owners to digital broadcasting. Old-style analog broadcasting must cease by February 18, 2009. Anyone who does not have a digital-ready television or converter by then won't be able to receive a picture. The transition will be long, expensive, and painful, but ultimately worth it, the article says, though I don't agree. More efficient use of the spectrum will lead to billions of dollars deposited in the U.S. Treasury from auction proceeds and more advanced services for wireless customers. The government estimates the auction, scheduled to begin January 16, 2008, will raise between $100 billion and $15 billion. And so this article goes on, raising many more questions in our minds that definitely need to be there. Now, you'll be able to catch the article I'm writing on the neocons stole freedom, so you'll be looking for it. But what this article does not say, and what I will be writing about this coming week, is the flawed theory and practice that's being used here. Why is the government putting into private hands what is effectively the roads that belong by right to all of us? Do you want someone else to own the roads you rely on to get to work, to the grocery store? Of course not. We may not be able to stop this round of greedy guts trying to profit from expropriating our property, but that does not mean we will be without recourse. What they are doing is clearly racketeering, and there will be an accounting, rest assured. Now, another issue that needs your immediate attention is the militarization of our police at the most local level. Through a program that extends at what local police think is a gift to unused federal property, they are finding that they are handing over their property to the feds. This is from an article by William Norman Grigg, available through LouRockwell.com. Get the link off the grids to freedom. When local police are supported by local tax funds, they are locally accountable. When those police are materially and financially supported by Washington, to any extent, the locus of control and accountability shifts there. That is the principle recognized in the Supreme Court's 1942, Wickard versus Filburn decision. The Bush regime is trying to expand that principle in the case of Joshua Wolf, a video blogger imprisoned on federal contempt charges last fall for refusing to surrender videotape sought by federal prosecutors. The feds claimed that Wolf's video contained footage of an attack by rioters on a San Francisco Police Department squad car during a July 2005 protest. Wolf maintained that he didn't have the footage sought by prosecutors, which allegedly showed the squad car being put on fire, and that under California's Shield Law, he doesn't have to surrender the tape. The feds countered that because of the SFPD receives federal subsidies for counter-narcotics and Homeland Security efforts, among other things, the damaged squad car is federal property, and so the matter belongs in federal court, where California's Shield Law doesn't apply. That claim is yet to be resolved in the courts, but given that claims of this sort have been consistently vindicated since, about 1937, the suspense isn't exactly killing me, the author says, which leaves us here. Any police agency that receives so much as a particle of federal aid is no longer a local police force. It is, in principle, a federal army of occupation, which should give the entire South pause for thought. They know what that's like. You need to know this. Remember that the defense is the losing position. Offensive action is needed. And now, we need to consider the web of deceit that brought us to this moment in time. The human tendency to look for messiahs, leaders who remove from us individually the need to experience our own God-granted power is one of the links in the chains that enslave us, body, soul, and mind. Today, we're going to begin a process of examining icons. This is also a process of self-examination, questioning why we fail to challenge authority, what authority means to us, what we give up sometimes so eagerly so that we can feel that we do not need to be responsible. This process will continue. There are a lot of icons out there that need to be reduced to human size so that we can see them, not as we hoped and imagined, but as they are. Our speaker today has had a lot of experience with icons. Connie Ruffley's first job out of school was with the FBI. That was a different time in American history, one where J. Edgar Hoover believed and acted as if local people should control their own police. Connie went on to have two children become active in UROC, United Republicans of California, the group that gave Barry Goldwater the boost that made him the Republican presidential candidate in 1964. Connie is a real conservative. Today we're going to go over the agenda that was carried out by two men, Ronald Reagan and William Buckley, as they abused our trust and installed a very different set of ideas that most people today believe is conservatism. You need to know. Please welcome Connie Ruffley.
Hi, Melinda.
I am so glad that you could be with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being with you.
Now, I told people just a little bit about your background. Could you, and we always like to get to know our guests a little bit more, so could you tell us a little bit more about Connie and her life?
Well, as you said, my very first job that I had when I was out of school was to work for the FBI. And it was a very, started off as a file clerk, and eventually I had a top secret clearance. And I'd met J. Edgar Hoover every year that he came out to Los Angeles, and he always came into the Los Angeles office and greeted the employees there. And he'd been doing that since about 1940, sometime in the 1940s, I believe it was. So I had that opportunity to meet him, and it was really, really quite a pleasure. I also met Robert Kennedy. It was the first time a U.S. Attorney General had ever visited in the field office of the FBI. And we girls hated it because he had this limp fish handshake or dead fish handshake, and he wouldn't look you in the eye.
Oh, how interesting.
We all felt very dirty after he left because we always had the feeling that he was trying to look down our blouses, and that was not nice. But anyway, from there, then I was a stay-at-home mother for a while, had two children. Then I became involved in sales and did some other interesting things, and then got married again. My husband was a business and financial consultant, and still is. And we had a couple of businesses which I helped him run, and then I started working with Judicial Watch.
Well, and so, that's an interesting part of your life too. So
yes,
that's what you do. You sort of run a branch office for Judicial Watch, right?
Yes, I do. And the Western West Coast Regional Office of Judicial Watch is the one that I run.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also involved with United Republicans of California and have been for about 10 or 12 years, as a matter of fact,
mm-hmm.
and have done its written resolutions. And now I'm the state co-chair of United Republicans of California.
Mm-hmm. And that's really quite an honor because that's an organization that did a tremendous amount. I mean, that is, you're really looking at American history when you look at UROC.
Oh, absolutely. Well, UROC exploded in membership back in 1963 when it was formed by then California State Senator Joe Shell and also Bruce Reagan, who was an assemblyman. And it was formed to fight against Nelson Rockefeller and the liberal wing of the Republican Party, especially at the time when Nelson Rockefeller was trying to get the nomination for president back in 1964.
Mm-hmm. So he was very much oppositional to Goldwater.
Oh, absolutely. Did everything in his power that he possibly could to derail Barry Goldwater. Mm-hmm. But it was the people power that actually succeeded in the end and got Barry Goldwater on the ballot, other than Nelson Rockefeller.
And if you take a look at what Rockefeller was about, some people, I mean, they hear the Rockefeller name and they vaguely know that it had something to do with oil, but they don't understand that the original Rockefeller fortune was founded on oil in a way that they probably aren't aware of. This is somebody who went after the original Rockefeller. They used violence. They used coercion. They used payoffs. They destroyed pretty much everything that they came across, and they had no compunction about doing that.
Absolutely. They were absolutely ruthless, and John D. Rockefeller even hired a public relations firm to show him in a good light, and of course there were all sorts of photographs of him giving away dimes on the streets of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that tried to put him in a better light, and they've been trying to work out from underneath that for a long, long time, or not so much work out from under it, but just trying to bury that portion of the past and make themselves look respectable.
And so here they were in the Republican Party, and it's very clear that their interest in the Republican Party from everything that they did was about creating a larger, more powerful government.
Exactly, under their control. You see David Rockefeller today, and he is the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he has this large, large Rolodex. I mean, it's not like the kind that you and I have. It's two of these things side by side, and they're probably about a couple feet in diameter that he keeps all of his cards and contacts on next to him and next to his desk so that he can contact anyone he wants at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's proud of the fact that that he is trying to bring about the New World Order. And, of course, the Rockefellers want to be at the head of that.
Yes, and, of course, now there's a certain amount of scorpion in the bottle moments going on mm-hmm. between the petroleum interests. But if you take a look at William Buckley, I think the thing that may be most ironic about this whole situation is that people think of him as sort of a New Englander, when in fact he is the son of an oil man born in Texas
mm-hmm.
who grew up in privilege, went to Yale, and then was confronted with the fact that not everybody was simply impressed by his money.
Right.
And then he was solicited by and joined the CIA as a covert agent in 1951. And the question that we need to ask ourselves is, did he ever leave?
I don't know. Well, basically the CIA is run by the Council on Foreign Relations, and it runs the State Department instead of the State Department running it. And I just don't think that it will ever change until we get rid of the CIA, as Ron Paul suggests.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
Otherwise, it's still always going to be run by the CIA. Dr. Stanley Monteith had made a comment one time at a Yurok Paul convention, I believe it was, and he said, the United States doesn't make stupid mistakes. They make big, complicated, stupid mistakes. And it's done on a purpose, you know, but because people say, why? Why is this happening? And they're very costly mistakes as well, too.
Oh, boy.
So,
and they don't seem to have any compunction about doing that. And if you take a look at Buckley's background and
mm-hmm.
the background of somebody else very much in our consciousness today, George W. Bush, you see two kids who are the children of big oil.
Mm-hmm.
One of them may be slightly smarter than the other, but otherwise there really isn't a lot of difference because they both have tried to position themselves as being New Englanders.
Right. And they just aren't. I mean, they're just out of Texas, and basically they're hicks just like Lyndon Baines Johnson was. But they have a lot of money. They have
mm-hmm.
a lot of power. They have a lot of influence, and they use it to their own betterment.
Mm-hmm.
And not for the betterment of the American people.
Absolutely. And Buckley, after 51, he went on with his career.
Mm-hmm.
And after he became an agent, they sent him to Mexico. And he actually gloated about the fact, once when he was sitting next to the president of Mexico, that he was there to undermine his regime, and he actually said that to him. And so you're seeing somebody, and this is something that Buckley reports himself in something he wrote, November
mm-hmm.
1st, 2005, editorial for the National Review. He recounted that.
Absolutely unbelievable the arrogance these people have when they you know, as if no one else matters except them, and you are just a pawn in a chess game that they are playing.
Mm-hmm.
And but now the people are beginning to wake up. They're seeing Ron Paul and who's taking a stance, and they're saying, "Gee, why didn't we know about this before?" And people such as Buckley, who've been the faux conservative for so long, and basically he was a straw man because people said, well, he's a conservative, and yet he deliberately lost every debate that he was with. I mean, how can you have someone that smart and yet be stupid enough to win to lose a debate? And it was all set up to make conservatives look really stupid.
Well, and that's what he did. He positioned himself to take over the term conservative, and at the same time systematically went after every individual who led that movement.
Correct.
And the whole thing, there's nothing accidental about it when you look at it.
No.
He actually defended Joseph McCarthy, and people have tried to position him as a conservative, but it's pretty clear that he really wasn't a conservative. And then he went after Barry Goldwater, he went after Robert Welch, and he went after Ayn Rand.
Right.
Each of whom was a leader in that movement at the time.
Correct.
And what he did to Robert Welch, he also did to the John Birch Society.
Yes, he did, as a matter of fact. Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society, has often been belittled as that New England candy maker, as if he were nothing. But one has to remember that Robert Welch graduated from high school at the age of 12. He graduated from college at the age of 18 and from the Naval Academy by the time he was age 20. Excuse me. He graduated from college when he was 16 and from the Naval Academy when he was 18. And so he was a very, very precocious person, and he knew exactly what was going on. And he would write letters to people. If he were alive today, he probably would have started out on the web with a blog but in those days, he was writing letters for people, and they were being passed around, and people wanted more and more of his advice. And so he started getting a little newsletter together, and it eventually turned into the John Birch Society.
Mm-hmm. And what they did was in-depth analysis of what ought to be, and they came up with a lot of different positions that I know surprise people today when they really understand what they stood for.
Right.
For instance, their stand on the Vietnam War.
Exactly. They were completely against it, and based upon the fact that it was not declared by the Constitution, which the Constitution says the Congress has to declare war. No one else has that power to do that. And in addition, Congress does not have the power to abrogate their authority to another branch of the government.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they can't give it to the judicial branch, and nor can they give it to the executive branch. But that's what they have done ever since the Korean War.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And this is amazingly like Ron Paul's position.
Exactly.
And again, he's been attacked for having the position that's actually constitutionally correct.
Yes. It's interesting about Ron Paul, when they were talking about declaring war on Iraq, he actually submitted a bill to Congress, his own bill, to declare war, have Congress declare war on Iraq. And then he was going to vote against it. But he wanted Congress to have the authority to do that, not the president. And he was told by, I believe, Henry Hyde, Mr. Paul, of course you understand that there are some things in the Constitution that we just don't do anymore. And that's why it was given over to the president, for him to use his quote-unquote best judgment.
Of course, you wonder whether or not he has any.
Well, one does. And, of course, George W. Bush happens to be a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. His father, before he became vice president under Reagan, was the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations and stepped down from that position to become Reagan's vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was announced at the Republican convention that George H.W. Bush was going to be Reagan's vice president, true conservatives just absolutely gasped, because this is probably the most liberal Republican who was ever out there. But Reagan had announced at the time, he says, well, I want someone who will match my own beliefs.
Well, he got somebody, evidently.
Yes, he did.
Because, and this is one of the things, because when, how did you feel when you started putting this all together and realizing to what an extent they had intentionally gone after the conservative movement and simply cold-bloodedly taken it over when they couldn't do it, and with a frontal assault on the Goldwater campaign?
Well, it was quite something, because you have no idea about the ruthlessness of these people and what they will stoop to in order to bring about these things. Nelson Rockefeller couldn't defeat Barry Goldwater at the nominating convention, and so they trolled around, and of course, and they found Ronald Reagan, who was the great communicator. And as many people know, Ronnie, before he became a conservative and showed up at the 1964 nominating convention and gave that wonderful conservative speech and everything, was on the head of the letterhead of two very left-wing organizations, which were, I can't remember the names of them right now, but basically they were to bring about the end of the sovereignty of the United States. But because Reagan had given such a wonderful, wonderful speech, which was bought and paid for by Joe Schell, which was supposed to have been given by Barry Goldwater. But because Ronald Reagan had delivered that speech and he did it so eloquently, and then people began to think, oh, Ronnie is one of us. He is great, because no one had heard of him or known about what he'd been doing except for the people who were really educated.
Mm-hmm.
And as to what was going on in politics. But everybody just fell in love with Ronnie and his love of the flag and the way that he talked about things, and he was very charismatic. And so that's how they duped the conservatives into believing that Ronald Reagan was truly a conservative when he wasn't.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
What did Ronald Reagan do to kind of create some sort of a resume for himself as a conservative? Not talking. Let's just ignore rhetoric, because he's an actor and that's easy. What did he do?
Exactly.
That said, I'm a conservative. Because if you look at Goldwater, you have a whole series of different votes. You had things that he did with, you know, it went as an activist in Arizona. You have
sure.
a lifetime of action that show you, yes, this man is a conservative and he believes it.
Mm-hmm.
What did Ronald Reagan ever do?
Ronald Reagan really did nothing at all. I mean, he was, before he became on the scene back in 1964, up until a few years before, he was still on the letterhead of this group, and no one really knew what he was doing. It's interesting, when Bill Clinton was during the 2000 election, no one had ever heard of Bill Clinton before. And so what it seems that they're doing is they are bringing these people out of nowhere, much like Barack Obama, and then touting them as this great person who's going to be coming along and saving everything. But Ronald Reagan was, you know, he was a delightful man, very charismatic, he was very funny, personable. I mean, you couldn't help but like him.
And people sort of fell in love with him, too.
Oh, they
even
did.
People who were ideological in Yurok.
Oh, sure, absolutely. We had a lot of people who were ideological in Yurok. And we had, you know, a great deal of people who were completely educated. And as Lincoln said, you know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, and you can fool all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time.
But he did fool Yurok and the people in Yurok, and that
yes.
caused a tremendous amount of unhappiness and, I'd have to say, real grief.
Well, it did, and there were friendships that were lifelong friendships that were broken up that were never mended after that, because some of the people absolutely did not want to believe, and they just absolutely could not bring themselves to believe that he was actually not what he appeared to be. They just
mm-hmm.
wanted to see the outside, and they just wanted to see the shell and all of the glitz and everything else, and not take a look at the inside of the man.
Mm-hmm.
And they just wouldn't do it. And I know that for some people, it's hard to believe, but as much as the John Birch people were educated, and probably more than the average person, 30% of them dropped out after Ronald Reagan became president. Because they said, boy, our guy Ronnie is in there, and we don't have to do anything anymore. And that's what really killed the conservative movement, was Ron Reagan.
Hmm. And
Sorry.
He had a lot of help, of course, from Buckley.
He did. there were a lot of other faux conservatives out there who, you know, jumped on the bandwagon, and it was all a charade. And true conservatives were then became too busy to take a look at what was really going on. And as Thomas Jefferson said, you cannot be ignorant and free, because the two of them don't work.
That's right.
They don't go together. And so you have to educate yourself. And my goodness, I think I've been involved with politics since I was about 13 years old. I had a mother who was a Democrat and a father who was a Republican, and they used to fight all the time. And when I went to work for the FBI, about that time my father was becoming very much involved with the Birch Society, and he would come home and tell us things. And that's when I did my investigation on my own, and because I had access to the files, and found out that what he was saying was right. And after I told my mother that my dad was right, then she converted and became a Republican, a Goldwater Republican, as a matter of fact.
That's great.
And her family up until that point, I mean, they had been staunch Democrats, and boy, he didn't say anything bad about Roosevelt, because, you know, he was, well, they weren't Catholics, but, you know, a lot of good Catholics have pictures of the Pope in there, and boy, if they had a picture of Roosevelt, that would have been it.
Mm-hmm.
And, but my mother was able to change everybody, because she, too, had become educated, and so now all of my cousins and my aunts and uncles are basically all very educated people, and it's through the efforts of my mother.
Well, they're certainly what I would call disillusioned, right?
They were
disillusioned. Because now they know what was really happening.
Exactly. And they educated themselves, and so you really have to sit down and take a look. I mean, if somebody tells you something, then it's just like being at the FBI. You say, okay, this is a track that you want to look at and everything, but is it really going to be leading you to the truth? One of the things that J. Edgar Hoover did was he wanted agents who were lawyers so that they would be able to know what evidence, you know, would be what they could take into court, and it would count as true evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so you cannot really disqualify where the truth comes from. And if it's something that you don't want to see, well, but you have to look at everything. And you can't just say, "Oh no, I don't want to hear that because it goes against what I've thought all these years." You have to look at the evidence, and it has to have weight. And I mean, my gosh, if we didn't have the internet now, there would be a lot of people who'd be really stupid. But you know, because they've been spoon-fed by the mainstream media rather than going out.
They wouldn't be stupid. They'd be uninformed. They would be ignorant. They would lack the facts, right?
Well, there's a difference between ignorant and stupid. Ignorant means that you've never been told the truth before, and so you didn't know. Stupid means you've been told the truth, and you still continue to go ahead in the same way that you were, doing the same thing that you were doing before.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's still a lot of ignorant people, and they're good people, and they haven't found the truth yet, but they're finding it. Many of them right now that's one of the reasons why Ron Paul has just exploded off the map. I mean, if the tools had been available back in Barry Goldwater's day that are available now to us, I'm sure that he would have been elected president.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, the mainstream media, you know, television, radio, and newspaper, basically are owned by the people who control everything, and that's basically the people who are involved with the Council on Foreign Relations. And they pick the editors, and they pick the reporters, and they tell them what they're going to print and what they're not going to print, and that's why there's so much bias in there. Such as when Ron Paul came in fifth in the Iowa straw poll, they talked about the top winners and they talked about the people at bottom, and they deliberately left out Ron Paul. They did not mention him one time at all.
That's right. And they had stolen it too, probably.
Well, he thought that they had said before he had gone in there that he probably would have been in maybe second or third from the bottom, but he came out fifth, and he didn't even have any voters there. I mean, the people who, Mitt Romney bought those votes, lock, stock, and barrel. He had people sign affidavits that once they got to the Iowa straw poll that they would not vote for anybody else. And once they got to the Iowa straw poll, they were immediately taken into voting booths and told them to vote. before they heard any of the speakers speak. And one of the people who had voted for Mitt Romney, after he heard Dr. Paul speak, he said, if I had heard you speak first, he said, I would have voted for you.
I think actually some of them were voted for Ron Paul anyway.
It's possible that they did, and they violated their affidavits, but we don't know. But, I mean, he bought the whole Iowa place. It was incredible. But, you know, today you don't have to have that much money because now the Internet is free. And one of the things we need to do is keep the Internet free. That's one of the pieces, I believe, of legislation that Ron Paul has brought about, is to keep the government away from the Internet.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And we need to keep that because it is so important to freedom of speech. And everybody talks about, oh, freedom of speech, and it's terrible, you know, and just being able to say anything that you want. But remember, when the Founding Fathers brought about the freedom of speech, it was the freedom to disagree with the government. That was what freedom of speech was, and it's what it should be still, to be able to disagree with the government.
Absolutely, and that's what it's all about, because that's
right.
How you enact change.
Exactly.
Is by disagreeing, getting it out there, and having people agree with you or not agree with you. They have a right to do that.
Exactly.
But they don't have a right to stifle your right to speak.
No.
Which, of course, is what they're doing. So,
right.
So here we're looking at a world where you'd have to take a look at the people we call the Rockefeller end of the Republican Party, who then
right.
crossed over, and you utilized people who crossed over in the 70s, the Crystals,
mm-hmm.
who became
sure.
the neocons. And you have a very fairly small cadre of people who are carrying out the work of what we think of today as the neocons, but
mm-hmm.
who knows what they would have called themselves. I think there's probably a lot of names.
Right.
And what they're doing is right in front of God and everybody, they're installing a fascist state using the charisma of Ronald Reagan
mm-hmm.
and I would have to say the political operative skills of William Buckley.
Right.
Because he had gone after very clearly anybody of prominence who was actually a conservative so he could steal the title.
Right. And he was, as I think we had spoken before, you know, he deliberately lost debates with liberals and everything, so that, and it just made conservatives look really stupid. But this is all a part of it, and everybody was, and of course he was touted by everybody as being this big conservative, and he was terrible. And he never would have been a Robert Taft Republican, nor would he have ever been a Goldwater Republican. But the mainstream media and all the people who were, as you had said earlier, Buckley was the son of an oil man, and he went to Harvard, and he developed an affected accent so that he sounded as if he were from back east rather than down in Texas, and had everybody conned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you can see that. And eventually, Yurok, even though they went through a tremendous amount of trauma because they had to realize that they had been taken advantage of.
Right.
After he was elected governor in California with their assistance.
Right. Well, that's what happened back in when everybody thought that Ronnie was such a great conservative, and then when he decided to run for governor, everybody was so taken in with him. Again, you know, you can have all the people fooled some of the time. The lady who's now the state co-chair of UROC with me, Marion Hurley, had a catered sit-down dinner for 400 people in her backyard in San Marino. And Nancy and Ronnie came down, and, of course, he gave another wonderful speech. And, of course, all the people in UROC at that time just went out and did all sorts of things to make sure that he became elected governor. And then once he became elected governor, they had given him, I think we talked about this before, had given him a list of people that they thought were really great conservatives who would be wonderful appointees, and they gave this list to Ronnie and thought, boy, that's, you know, Ronnie's our boy, everything is just going to be great now. And then as the Reagan administration progressed in California, they were finding that he was appointing all sorts of people that no one had ever heard of before.
Big surprise coming up, huh?
Big surprise. And people were saying, well, we don't know who these people are. We have no way of knowing who they are. And so someone had the bright idea of writing to the Secretary of State and getting a list of people who were dedicated to to Nelson Rockefeller at the Republican convention. And sure enough, that's where all those people came from.
He accepted the help of Yurok, and of course the deal was that he was going to install a conservative administration.
Right.
And then he turned around without a blink and installed an administration that was made up of what we would today know as neocons.
Exactly. And after that, then people said, well, you know, we're going to watch him really closely, and what we're going to do is we're going to watch the newspapers and record everything that he has done for a year's time. And at that time, that was in 1975, on May 4th of 1975, at a state spring convention, they did a resolution which condemned Ronald Reagan and said that he was unfit to be either president or vice president of the United States.
Now, let me read that, okay?
Sure.
I have it right here in front of me.
Okay.
Subject, opposition candidacy of Reagan. Ronald Reagan has made eloquent conservative speeches while his deeds have served the liberals. Whereas, despite Reagan's claim of conservatism since 1950, the left dominated his politics prior to 1960. Whereas, during his 1966 gubernatorial race, Reagan selected liberal Rockefeller men to run his campaign, and upon election, his appointments continued in the same pattern, excluding conservatives. Whereas Reagan supported Nixon's leftist policies, praised Kissinger, and betrayed conservative candidates. Whereas Reagan promised economy but doubled the state budget and raised taxes. Whereas Reagan actively promoted regional government contrary to his expressed philosophy of local government. Whereas under Reagan, liberal educational programs accelerated and PPBS, a budgetary process of political change, established moving public schools toward total state control. Whereas Reagan also betrayed conservative principles in the areas of property rights, income tax withholding, gun control, medicine, mental health, welfare reform, crime control, etc. Therefore, be it resolved that Yurok oppose Ronald Reagan as candidate for president or vice president and urge Americans nationwide to carefully scrutinize his record.
Correct.
So, what was left of the conservative movement, which at that point was pretty well shattered, some of them heard the message and some of them didn't. But I think it's interesting that today so few people who would consider themselves conservatives really understand that we were warned.
They were. It's unfortunate that at the time that resolution came out, there were some people who were still so shocked at the, even though it was well documented. I mean, you read one page of the resolution, but the documentation goes on for three pages.
It's not fairly small print.
Right.
It's very well documented. It names times, it names names, and it says exactly what happened. I have made a copy of this, the original, just a Xerox of the original copy, and what I'm going to be is I'm going to be putting the JPEGs up online so that people can look at this and understand exactly what happened.
That's great. I really appreciate that, Melinda.
And if you take a look at the appointments, I mean, a lot of these names kind of jump right at you because you know who these people are.
Yes.
It's kind of scary.
It's very scary, and it's easy to take advantage of conservatives. It's easy to take advantage of anybody, but I think conservatives are more trusting because we believe in God and we believe in basically the goodness of people. And when someone is a traitor like this, I mean, it just really hurts us. And I just don't think that anybody really thought that Reagan would be able to. Was capable of being deceitful, and I think that's what really hurt. But there were some people who just couldn't see through that at all, and they were so beguiled by his charm and his wit and everything else that these things would just never apply. You know, it's like some lady who was on the O.J. Simpson trial and on the jury. And she just said afterwards to a friend of hers who said to her, you know, weren't you on the O.J. trial? And she said, why didn't you find O.J. guilty? And she said, oh, O.J. would never do that. I mean, he could never do that. So there are people who feel the same way about Ronald Reagan. You know, he could never do that. And
don't bother me with the evidence.
Don't bother me with the facts. You know, my mind is already made up. And when they look at the, they just want to see Ronald Reagan for, you know, with a great smiling face and that wonderful head of hair and those big square shoulders. And there he was with his cowboy hat and on his horse and everything. And that's the way that they want to remember him and think about him. But they don't really want to see the facts behind the man. And it's a tragedy. It truly is. It's a tragedy for America. It's a tragedy for Americans who still that way, still feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you see young Republicans, too, who were really too young to remember Ronald Reagan or anything else, but, you know, they invoke the name of Ronald Reagan and suddenly become misty-eyed and their, you know, eyes water up and they're fluttering back tears and different things because Ronald Reagan is still being touted to us as the icon of the conservative movement.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he very much is, though. I don't know how many, if anybody's been doing a count of how many times he's been touted in the last couple months.
Oh, well, almost every single debate that you have out there with the Republicans, I mean, they all tout, you know, trot out the name of Ronald Reagan. I think that Ron Paul, even though he supported him back in 1976 for, you know, the Texas delegate for president at the Republican convention, I don't believe he's even ever said the name of Ronald Reagan since he's been on the debate.
Well, I think he probably understands because he's
right.
Probably gotten the information. But there's something about saying something bad about somebody that you love that's very difficult. It was really hard for me to write that article because I loved Ronald Reagan.
Oh, sure. Well, you knew him personally.
Yes.
And that makes it even harder when you've known somebody and have seen how good he was and what a sweet, lovely man he was, too. And then to find out this other side, just a juxtaposition that people just can't fix in their minds. It's too duplicitous. You know, Ronnie would never do anything like that.
Looking at this documentation, it's on page two.
Right.
Betrayed conservative candidates. One of the things I thought that was the saddest was number two, Joe Shell.
Yeah.
Reagan had promised to support conservative Joe Shell for governor in 1966, and this is a man that let him read the speech at the 64 convention and paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Reagan pushed to run himself to stop hard conservative Shell, and signs pointed increasingly to Rockefeller in the wings, along with Rockefeller's campaign manager.
Yeah.
Source, closer up, 5/21/65.
Right.
And that must have been such a hard and painful moment for Joe Shell, too.
It must have been. I've met Joe Shell, but I've only met him on one occasion, and he's just a very, just a true gentleman, just like Ron Paul is, and just above board and ethical, and he would have been made a fine, fine governor, and I'm just absolutely destroyed by Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a level at which it's hard once you've been betrayed that way to even go back to politics because it's painful to sort of be there after you've gone through that kind of thing.
Right.
And there was that level of trauma that took place with people who had gone through this and trusted Ronnie and believed that absolutely in him that he was going to do the right thing for America.
Exactly. No, it was just too hard for too many Americans to accept, unfortunately. And
mm-hmm.
But it's sort of similar, very similar, as we had spoken at another time about Martin Luther King. When people don't really see the evidence of it, they've never heard the tapes that have been shut away for 50 years by Ronald Reagan, and every year his legacy grows. Same thing with Ronald Reagan's as well, too. When they don't see the true facts and everything, then every year his legacy grows as well.
And that's one of the reasons, of course, that it really is important to take, you know, to take on icons.
Yes.
So that people see them for what they are, and then if they don't do that, they can't understand the whole flow of history. And that begets this thing, and I think it was Karl Marx who said, if you can disguise from people their own history, you can control them.
True. And that's what they're doing. That's why we have revised history in our classes so that people don't, you know, kids growing up are being brought up with a wrong idea of what our history was about. They talk about robber barons, but they don't talk about the people who were, you know, kind and loving, and like John Deere, who started the John Deere Manufacturing Company. He and his wife lived in a very modest house because they were Christians, and they had and they prayed all the time, and they took all the money that they had that they didn't need to live on and sent it to the missionary field. Unlike the robber barons such as the Rockefellers and the Goldman Sachs people, and the other was, you know, the members of the Council on Foreign Relations. But nobody ever talks about the John Deere people who were so good.
No, they don't. And unfortunately, what we've done is we've let these people with huge amounts of money buy their way in to respectability, and that was a mistake on our parts.
Exactly. So we have an uphill battle, but I think that so many Americans are waking up now, and the young people have known for a long time that something was wrong. They didn't know what it was, and now that they are coming around to Ron Paul, I mean, this country is going to turn around.
You can see it, and there's something that it just makes you want to cry when you take a look at that and you realize how much we have been hungry for this.
Really? I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I've been to other organizations and things, and you don't see it. But when you go to the Ron Paul meetup groups, I mean, the excitement, the electricity in the air is palpable. And like Sean Hannity was trying to poo-poo Ron Paul and saying, well, it's just a bunch of spammers for Ron Paul who are out there, and, you know, they're flooding the results and everything. But you can't do it because there were a couple of people who said, okay, let's see if we can spam this. But when they called in or when they text in with their, gone on the computers or whatever they do for texting, and it says, sorry, but you've already voted and you can't vote again. So, truly, the media is trying to downplay Ron Paul, and, of course, now they're going to be getting vicious because they couldn't demean him because there are too many people who are onto their scheme right now.
Amen. That's what Gandhi said. Then they fight you,
then you
win.
Right.
Amen. We're getting to the point where we're going to have to close, but I really didn't want you to go away without giving us your contact information, because one of the things I wanted to tell people is that you're going to be helping get registrations for Ron Paul in California, and I think that's fantastic. It's wonderful to think of that connection through time where the same people who helped Goldwater do what he did and tried to do for America are now going to help Ron Paul.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to be back there, and instead of, working with shoe leather and mimeographs and phones, we're still going to be using the phones and cell phones and the blogs, and now people can register online, which I think is wonderful. Of course, we don't want the illegal aliens to do that, but people who are independents or who have decided not to state which party they are for can now vote. Can now register as Republican, and even if they just want to say, oh my gosh, the party is gone downhill, there's a feminist group that's up in Northern California, and they said, just try being a Republican for 3 weeks, okay? Just long enough to vote in the primary, and then you can go back and do whatever you want.
That works for me.
Works for us.
Yeah.
So, but, we do
want...
Could
you give people your URL?
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. It is www.UnitedRepublicansOfCalifornia.org. And United Republicans of California is all run together. There aren't any dots or anything else in there. And you can then sign up for, join us. We'd love to have you join us. We're going to be having our fall convention on Saturday, September 29th. We're having Dr. Michael Kaufman come, and he's going to be speaking on global warming or global governance. Constance Cumby, who's an attorney from Detroit, Michigan, will be coming out, and she'll be talking about Javier Solana, who happens to be the head of the European Union and is probably and has been touted as the most powerful man in the world, and we need to know about him because
nobody
knows about him. And then we're having Mr. Chris Farrell, who's the Director of Research and Investigations for Judicial Watch, come out and speak on the Security and Prosperity Partnership, as well as the North American Union, and how we need to stop that, because If we don't stop it and the North American Union goes forward, we will lose our sovereignty and our rights and everything that we have come to love as Americans.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me to be on the program with you today, Melinda.
And God bless, and you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, and you too.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Then that's our show for today, Friday, September 7th, 2007. We need the truth. If we owe each other nothing else, we owe that to everyone. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster, coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that eventually brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.